What rank were you in the army when you were at Sandhurst?
Well, that'll depend on whose opinion you you take.
We're straight into it, aren't we? We haven't even pressed. We haven't done the introduction yet. But
we'll do your introduction, because I think it's important you get your strap line.
Let's do the... Back in March, I quoted Seamus Heaney to my colleagues. And Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet, said, "If we can winter this out, we can summer anywhere." We then went on to have an early summer. And amongst the tragedy and the mayhem, I was delighted to hear the birdsong and wake up to blue skies in the morning. The world was full of woe and wonder. Now, this brings me to my next guest. And I looked at his LinkedIn profile, and I misread his LinkedIn profile because I thought it said he was a fast talker, which I thought, well, that's absolutely correct. And he's put on his profile that it does exactly what it says on the tin. But apparently that's not correct. I misread it. What it does say on his LinkedIn profile is that you can improve profits fast by talking to drivers. And my next guest specialises in risk management and training. Now, have you ever wondered why an Irizar coach or a Van Hool coach shares a name with Sir Alex Ferguson, Jose Mourinho, or even better, Carlo Ancelotti, the coach at Everton? Well, that's because to coach in the Middle Ages meant to carry somebody in a sit-down chair. So a coach would carry wealthy people across London to avoid them standing in the mud. So a coach would carry valuable people from one place to another, a geographical place to another. Today, a coach takes valuable people and transports them not from one geographical place, but to one talent place, to another talent place. It elevates skill and it takes them from one place to another. And that's what my next guest does. He provides training. And sometimes when you're doing training, it's like trying to see the mountain whilst clinging onto a cliff edge. And my next guest has broken it down into bite-sized chunks and he's doing it all online. So no matter what the weather is outside, it's always summer when you're talking to David Summers of Road Skills Online. David, welcome.
Ian, what a pleasure to meet you this morning.
It's great seeing you.
I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, for the better, we've already started, haven't we? We couldn't wait to get going. So we did start a moment ago, listeners, at this ITT Hub. And what I want to get straight into it is David went to Sandhurst for his military training. And at Backhouse Jones here, I should say, I am a lawyer. It doesn't make me a bad person. And I've spent 25 years representing people in and outside of the transport industry, and I act for captains of the transport industry, and it has to be said, charlatans with an eye for a main chance. So I want to find out what military rank David achieved at Sandhurst and whether he was a captain. David, welcome, back the truck up, take me back to Sandhurst. And what was it like? Did you have cold showers in the morning?
Well, if I have to come back to you, Ian, and thank you for that introduction, it's an interesting comparison with, I didn't entirely recognise myself, so you've been very kind. And it was the same when I got my territorial decoration, I have to say, talking about the army. We were down at Woolwich Garrison in London, which was the unit I was attached to at the time. And on a Sunday morning, after we'd done our work, we used to have a general meeting in the Grand Hall, and the quartermaster would give various notices and awards. And he was reading a citation out this particular Sunday morning, and I listening carefully to what was being said, and I thought, oh, this chap's done a bit. You know, I wonder who it is, because there'd be anything up to 100 of us there. He's done a few tours and things. And then to my absolute surprise, at the end, he announced my name, and I didn't realise I'd done that much in such a short time in the army. They did embellish a little bit, but anyway, I got my territorial decoration. I never went back in case they found out the truth. So the truth is what you're after.
Yeah, how did you, tell us how you found yourself at Sandhurst.
Okay, I'd had an ambition as a teenage schoolboy at Kendal Grammar School to join the army by getting a commission. And quite frankly, at that age, I hadn't got the confidence to go for it, so I didn't. And I ended up doing something else useful, which was I got a teacher training qualification. But after that, I went over to Leeds and took a sales job, not teaching. 20% more money and a car, 21, swung my thoughts. And then I was playing at Headingley with one or two chaps there who were in the army already. So they gave me some really positive encouragement. So I applied, I got in. Oh, can I sidetrack? No, I won't sidetrack. It'll take too long.
Come back to it.
Maybe at the
hold
end.
The thought, but definitely come back. Yeah. This podcast is all about sidetracking, and we will come back to it. So the rules don't apply here.
Well, I'm just thinking whether I can actually be public. I think I can be public about this story. Because it's a long time.
Edit it out if it's bad. Don't you worry. Yeah. I'm going to write down here sidetrack, so remind me. Go on, carry on.
So I applied, I got in, I went down to the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, I got through the course, brilliant experience, opened up my mind, my social awareness, my world awareness, everything. I have to say it was an absolutely outstanding experience for me. And I was plunged into a level of lifestyle that was completely new to me, which was the officer's mess of the Prince of Wales's own regiment of Yorkshire. And in that fine body of men, I climbed the slippery pole to the high rank of lieutenant in the 3 years that I was there. So I did what they call a short service commission.
Yeah.
And commanded my platoon, did two tours in Londonderry and Northern Ireland, and did a fantastic exercise summer in Canada. And lots of stuff in Germany, and then I completed my short service career and ended up going into transport. So I got to lieutenant in the regular army, but I joined the territorial army, went to our territorial battalion, and rose to the heady heights of major.
So do I need to call you major now? Do I?
Well, a lot of people do.
I think I'm going to.
But I'm not sure it's out of deference or humour.
No, I'm going to do it out of deference. Major.
I've been called major disaster, major upset.
What's it like leading men? What is it like leading men?
Oh, it's exciting.
Yeah.
It's stimulating. You have to reflect on what you do and how you do it. And I'll give you an example. The first tour I did in Londonderry, there was a general ambience of socialising in the mess. So unless we were particularly on duty at the time, you know, you'd have a drink in the evening before and after dinner and so on. But reflecting on that 4 months, the second time I went, a year later, I decided I was going to go teetotal for the tour. And the main reason for that was my responsibilities to the men that I was permitted to lead, so that I would be at my best, thinking clearly, acting clearly, listening clearly, and giving them a positive point of leadership.
What did the men say when you gave up drinking?
I don't think I announced it. I just didn't do it.
Okay. Were you frightened at all in Londonderry?
There was one or two cautious moments, you might say, but if you think back to when we were all young, whatever we did, we were far more daredevil in your early 20s than we are when we're older. And that characteristic, I mean, my soldiers were 18, 19, 20, and that characteristic, I think, prevailed. And it's the one that it'll never happen to me, isn't it? Sadly, it happens to somebody, but no one ever thinks it's going to be them.
And if you were frightened, how do you not communicate that to your team or your platoon?
Training in the army is so far ahead of the rest of society.
Is that right?
Yeah.
In what ways?
It's procedural. Everything is about procedures. And by the time you get to command, the course at Sandhurst is so intense, so organised, so specific, and there's a procedure for everything. And I think it's the procedures that carry everybody through.
Do they teach you to control your emotions?
I don't recall that, but there was very much the old-fashioned approach of, you know, stiff upper lip and pull yourself together. But having said that, that wasn't to say the army was a cold or a callous place. always espouse the amazing capability of the men who reach the rank of WO2 and become company sergeant majors. You know, their father and big brother to 120 men.
I am fascinated by military history, and I've just read about the East India Company and how it got to control India and the management of men and the control of men and getting them, and I'm picking on men, and women are now allowed in the army, and at the time I presume women weren't at Sandhurst when you were there.
Not in the what you call the teeth arms, no. They were very much administrative background in rear area units.
And so in terms of discipline, how do you enforce discipline within a platoon?
Interesting question. And one I suspect is often misunderstood by people who've not experienced the military. It's very hard to enforce discipline. And I think, two or three things I could mention. If you try to enforce discipline, you've got unwilling people. And unwilling people don't go where you want them to go or do what you want them to do or do it the way you want them to do it. So you have to set an example. And I think the parallels for this in the transport industry, ones that I've always tried to carry across. So how does the army do that? Well, the regimental system is a powerful tool. Fortunately, with modern times and budgets, it's fading a little bit. But it's the esprit de corps, right down from section level, where you have 8 soldiers, including plus a corporal and a lance corporal. And at that level, they live, work, eat, sleep, dig, run, sweat, suffer together. And that esprit de corps then builds up in the pyramid through the different levels. And people do what they do as much for each other, because they are the people placed in that situation, as they do for the cause, if you like. So I don't think we ever enforced discipline as a regular management technique. That's the difference with leadership. And I've met lots of senior people from my own regiment who served in various theatres of the Second World War, and I'm conscious of a little bit of my own father's background in Burma and the horrendous experiences that they all had to go through. You can't do that by enforcing discipline. What happens maybe as a comparison when you enforce discipline is you have 12 million soldiers killed like the Russians did.
That's fascinating. And I do read military history, and I read that men don't fight. And I'm picking on men here. Primarily because they do fight in frontline battles, but it said that men don't fight for the queen, they don't fight for the country, they don't fight for the regiment, they fight for their mates, for the platoon, and that's why platoons are designed as they are. Yeah. The same as a rugby team, which we may come on to later.
And
I've experienced that running this practice. It's relatively easy running a firm of 15 people, but when you get to 50 and beyond, it becomes far more difficult. Mm. In terms of Brexit, and we've got Brexit coming, and I don't know if there's going to be a Hollywood ending there, and we've got COVID, so we've got a double whammy. Which historical military figure would you like to bring back to manage Great Britain in its current position?
There are several candidates. Clearly, Montgomery is a candidate because of the high-profile positions he held and the leadership he brought to the organisations that he commanded. But I think an often overlooked man is Alan Brooke, who was effectively the UK chief of staff for all military matters, Churchill's right-hand man.
Why was he overlooked?
I think he's overlooked not in those who know of his work and achievement, but he isn't generally recognised by the public. Everybody's heard of Montgomery, for example, for obvious reasons and sound reasons. But Alan Brooke was the chief of staff for the UK, effectively. So
Churchill's military right-hand man, and he was there right throughout the war, well, most of the war. And, you know, he got things organised and got things moving. He had to manage, and I'm trying to connect with your question in relation to Brexit. Yeah. You know, he had to manage the issues of, well, we've got to defend our island. We've got the Far East to defend. We've got to defend access through to the oil through North Africa. We've got to develop plans with our fantastic supporters from the US. And we've got to get some second front going somewhere because the Russians are crying out for support. And all these strategic balls to juggle. And he every leader has the great right-hand man. And Churchill is known as a great leader, but he must have had Alan Brooke as his great. Alan Brooke must have been his great right-hand man. And all those strategic things were dependent on military operations, and that was his basket.
What do you think great leaders have in common, and which adversary, which foreign military leader do you admire?
Interesting. I don't know if great leaders always have things in common. I mean, Genghis Khan probably didn't have too much in common with Winston Churchill, in that they had a completely different approach to the welfare of the people in the forces and under command. And the same between the West and Russia during the Second World War. I've been watching a lot of Yes Minister lately.
Oh, yes.
So remind me of what the question is.
The question was, the question is twofold. What do great leaders have in common, shall we say? And then also the other part of the question is, which foreign leader do you admire? I always like Napoleon. The reason why I like Napoleon is, I'm quite sure why I like, but apparently when he had to move his armies around France, and so they wanted to move in the summer when the sun was very high and it was very hot, as we go back to my theme of summer. And so the army couldn't move because it was very hot to walk. And so Napoleon decided that they should build some very tall, shady trees along the road so that the army could move in the shade. And so he ordered for these trees to be built. And his number two said, but you know, General, they'll take 30 years to grow. And he said, well, we should start tomorrow. And I'm sure it sounded better in French. But that long-term planning. So the question is, and we'll come back to long-term planning, and who's your military hero from abroad? And if you don't want to answer that, have you ever driven a tank?
A leader from abroad, but not military.
Yeah, go on.
I mean, there are one or two. I think Eisenhower was another great leader because he had lots of balls to juggle strategically. But I'm a huge admirer of Ronald Reagan and during his presidency.
Why is that?
Well, he tackled the most significant issue that could lead to world conflict that existed at the time. And he always appeared with a sense of humour.
Yeah, he did.
And said great things, but with humour. And never put people down.
Do you think there's a dearth of leadership at the moment in the world?
I do. I have a popular opinion, which is that politicians have become just the equivalent of civil servants, really. They go in as a career, and they're not coming from the workplace with all the experience that would bring.
Do you think more people from the military should go into politics?
There's no reason why they shouldn't, because I think it's right that our representatives are drawn from a cross-section of society. And I guess that's my point, is now they're not, in that so many of them go in as young people to be assistants and researchers, and then they get a seat to stand for. And that politics has been their whole life.
I agree with that. I think there's too many journalists in politics, and there's probably too many lawyers as well. But in terms of journalists, I've said this before, the phrase I don't like most is sort of, it's easy, you just, because whatever comes after the word just is just, it is trite, and the world is shades of grey, which I suppose military people have to encounter on a regular basis, whereas journalists just have to write about it. So I too have lost the question. So I'm going to go back to, and we'll move into, we have to try and shift this.
Oh, I've driven a tank.
Have you driven a tank?
Yeah. I have. Yeah.
What was that?
Unofficially. Well, you just do it. I mean, it's big. And
what kind of tank was it?
Chieftain. The Chieftain was the main battle tank in my army time. And we used to work in battle groups, so some tanks and some infantry together under one command. So naturally, you're parked up for the evening. It was, believe it or not, give us a ride in your tank.
Oh, so you weren't supposed to be driving the tank.
No. Can I have a go?
Is there a limitation on being court-martialed? I'm hoping to interview Colonel Adam Fraser-Hitchens shortly, who's a fellow colleague of mine from the IRTE. And he's a trustee of the Society of Engineers.
Yeah.
So maybe we should edit this part. Adam, if you're listening, I know his name and address. So he's been driving one of your Chieftain tanks without permission.
Oh, well,
what does it look like? Assuming Adam doesn't mind, tell us what you think.
Well, we're so used to modern cars now, it's hard to think back to what it was like driving any vehicle 40 years ago without power steering. They don't have power steering. Well, it's levers, and that's getting used to, because you pull a lever and it wrenches it over, so you've got to ease the lever, a bit like squeezing the trigger on a rifle, really.
Yes.
You have to ease the lever. So I guess in some ways you had to learn a bit of advanced driving to learn the point at which you now needed to squeeze the lever to begin the turn at the right time.
Yeah. A friend of mine, he was a tank commander, he drove a Chieftain tank in the Bosnian War. And I said, what was it like? He said, well, it was very noisy. He said, I don't know about the enemy, but it frightened me to death. Why did you leave the army? And then at what juncture did you get into transport?
Okay. I think I left the army. The root thing that got the thought in my head was... looking for a little bit more action, but then being advised by my commanding officer, a brilliant man, Major General Edwin Beckett, as he became the late Major General now, sadly. But he advised me on my career, and that if I went off to do an attachment in the Yemen or something like that, it wouldn't sort of count as service for the promotion ladder. And I reflected on that and I thought, well, I can predict, I could see 2 years of a desk-based type of job coming up, then a soldier-connected job, then another desk job coming up. That's how it works, because you've got to learn to do the staff work. And at that young age, I guess I might have been a bit naive, but I thought, but I'd want to do more boots on the ground with soldiers, you know. So that got me thinking in that direction. My brother had started his own little business in building and plumbing, and he was doing quite nicely. And I thought, oh, maybe I could work for myself. Very naive, Ian. And that got me into transport. I thought, well, what will I do? I'm an infantry officer. What am I going to do when I go out? Now, back then, there wasn't the recognition of the transfer of capability, the huge management training that one had been given in the services, there wasn't that recognition that all that could be taken out and used in companies. So he goes, what shall I do? What can I do for myself? And I thought, ooh. I was driving down the Autobahn. I almost remember this thought coming to me. I'll buy a truck. There must be loads of work for trucks. And that's how I got into it. And that's what I did.
And so did you pass your HGV test whilst you were in the army?
Ah, now there comes the sidetrack. When I was applying, I failed the eye test. So I was sent for a specialist examination by a consultant at Catterick Military Hospital. And because I was playing a decent level of rugby, I was in good physical shape, he felt that it would be a shame to lose a potentially decent candidate for the services because I could only see out of one eye.
So right.
He wrote, he said, technically you failed, but he said, I'll write the report, which suggests that you're good for duty.
And this was when you were joining the army?
This was before I joined.
Oh, right. So, yeah. So you got in sort of...
on the hook.
Let's hope Adam Fraser Hitchin's not listening to this. Colonel Fraser Hitchin, you might want to look further into this.
Well, Colonel Adam, you perhaps don't want to listen any further because there's worse to come.
Come on. Spill the beans. This is confessional. Get it out
there. Brilliant man, wrote that, and that got me in.
Yeah.
But of course, when we were leaving Sandhurst, after we'd passed out, we were given a medical.
Yes.
On the basis they were okay when they left here. So I went through the cubicle and Corporal somebody or other said, right, cover one eye, read the chart, sir. So I covered one eye, read the chart, right down to the bottom line in those days with my working eye. He said, now the other eye. And I thought, oh, I'm not having all this again. And I just did it like that and read the chart again with what appeared to me my vanity. And I was away again.
And did he not notice?
No, he didn't notice.
Did he, excuse the pun, did he turn a blind eye or did he just not notice?
He does not notice, I don't think. The hand, what is it? Sleight of hand?
The sleight of hand, yeah.
And, but then, so every year when we had a medical, I just did that. I covered the same eye, but with the opposite hand. But then it came to a head when I was I got my HGV3 in the unit.
Yes.
Commanding officer kindly permitted me to do that.
Yes.
And then for my resettlement course, I went to upgrade it to class one and do it drive Arctics.
Yeah.
So I got to the driver training school in Liverpool and we all started off and we were all paired off and we did half a day's in the vehicle every day. And, they checked documentation alphabetically as the week progressed. It was a 2-week course. So S wasn't got round to till Wednesday evening when we finished. And they said, where's your license? So I got what I thought was my license out and presented it. And she said, no, we need your driving license. So I said, well, that's all I've got. No, he said, that's just a permit to drive British Army vehicles in Germany. It's not a driving license. Oh, my God, he's been out on the road for 3 days and he's not got a license. So he said, don't worry, look, we'll switch your training round tomorrow and we'll send you down to Chester Garrison to the medical officer there for a medical. So, of course, I thought, oh, no, this could be trouble. So we drove down to Chester from Liverpool as part of our training and I checked in and there was a great big hail fellow well-met medical officer that was going to check my eyesight. Of course, by that time, it wasn't just cover your eye with your hand. It was look through this machine and then we can see everything. I thought, oh no, this is the end of the line here. And he said, I don't understand it. He said, you would never have got in the army with eyesight at this level. So he said, well, what regiment were you in? And I said, I was in the Prince of Wales's own regiment of Yorkshire, sir. He said, oh, my goodness. He said, my son was the adjutant. You might know him. And he gave me his name. I said, I do. He gave me 14 extra duties when I came back from my Warminster course. Oh, that's the stuff, eh? Character building. Look, he said, I'm sure all this licensed business is okay. And he signed the form. And there I was through.
You're living a charmed life, aren't you? So let's get back to the script. I have to get the word back in. I'm supposed to get back to the script. Back. I'm supposed to talk about transport. I'm supposed to talk about technology, which we will come to. So where are we in years? And so you've got your license. Did you work with your brother?
No, because they were separate businesses. Right, cool. But no, I built a small transport business up through the 80s. And that's where I learned what goes into our training content now and has gone into my consultancy content and training for the last 25 years.
Let's focus on the consulting because that's what you're doing now. Yeah. So you had a haulage business.
Yes, I had a haulage business. And I realised...
What were you hauling?
General UK and European.
How many, what was the size?
We got up to 15 at one time. Yeah. Yeah. But I realised once we got beyond four or five vehicles, which was a nice little group of manageable people, collisions went up. And we were having too many insurance claims.
Yeah.
So I started to do, I recognised, first of all, why are we having them? And I pointed the finger at me.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't managing that aspect of the business.
Yeah.
So I just introduced a toolbox talk program. And every Friday afternoon as drivers came back in, or Saturday morning, or Sunday afternoon even as they were going out, I just have 5 minutes with them. And I based my theory. There's another great military leader, Bill Slim, General Bill Slim, commander of the 14th Army in Burma. In one of our military books, there was a quote from Bill Slim when he went round units in the front line, talked to soldiers, try and give them some purpose. He would talk to them about Red Cross parcels, mail from home, quality of the food, had they got their kit through. His message was the last 20 seconds of his 2 minutes or 1 minute with a private soldier. So that's the principle I followed. I'd see the lads coming in, I'd talk to them about their week, what they were doing at the weekend. Sunday, I'd talk to them what they'd done about the weekend, what was coming up in the week. And then just at the end of that conversation, a couple of minutes, I'd talk to them about what can we do together as a team to reduce the number of collisions we're having. And I'd ask questions. I came up, Tony Robbins stole this from me and made it a worldwide phenomena, three ways. And I came up with this. What are three ways we could do this? Or what are three things we could do to achieve that? And I always got answers, and I still do get answers when I ask drivers those questions. We resolved the collision problem. And I one or two little anecdotes from that era.
Tell them to us, please.
There's what I call...
This podcast never has too many anecdotes. I may tell a few myself, but you can absolutely win against me in an anecdote polishing story. Tell the anecdotes. We've got all the time in the world.
Okay. It was it's the Mick Bradley story. Really good lad. He was in his late 20s, one of my drivers, totally reliable. And he was part of the team that solved this problem. But it started off with this little exchange, went on for about 8 weeks. When Mick Bradley comes in, ask him to come and see me. Okay, so, boss, you wanted to see me? Yes, I do, Mick. You had that collision 2 weeks ago on the M20 down near Maidstone. And he was doing about 3 miles an hour in the heavy roadworks. And using my vehicle as a mobile barricade to stop a lady in a small red car using her vehicle as a mobile battering ram to join the motorway. And they came together as a collision. We're at fault because he actually hit her, even though she was pushing in. So I said to him, what could you have done to prevent that happening? Arms folded up, jaw went in. Wasn't my fault. She shouldn't have been pushing in. She's supposed to give way. Yeah, I know that. But what could you have done to prevent it happening? I said, leave it with you. See you next week. And this went on for 8 weeks. And after about 8 weeks, and I'd seen him five or six times over those 8 weeks. You got a minute, boss? Yeah, come in, Mick. I'm not saying it was my fault. But if I'd let her in, probably none of this would have happened. And I didn't know if he meant him having to come to see me every other week or the collision. But I gave him the benefit of the doubt and thought, well, he's realised that there's a difference between right and wrong and avoidability. And that's one of the foundations that I built all our training and consultancy guidance.
So when did you go into training? When did you first go into training?
Around that time.
What year would this be?
Early 90s.
Right. Okay.
Early 90s. I was approached by a chap coming out the... We did lots and lots of CPC courses in army garrisons all over the UK and Germany. I was approached by a chap coming out who said, look, I'm interested in starting a driver training business for companies. Would you sponsor it? And can I come and work for you and set it up? So we said, yes, okay. And that's how we got into training.
And so Who's your first client? Don't give you his name. How did you find clients, basically?
Well, those were the days, Ian, when you could go into your office at 7 o'clock and pick the phone up at 7:30 and dial the senior executives in business. And that's what I did. And we got Parcelforce as our first client, believe it or not. And we did a series of training projects for them at about 5 different depots and had a big impact on collision experience. We'd adopt an approach based on experiential learning by Sir John Whitmore, who I was introduced to by a chap called Brian Ashton, who was running the West Yorkshire Police Driver Training School at the time. And we took this experiential approach on board and tried to make it workable commercially.
This podcast is interested in entrepreneurship.
Oh, yeah.
And so, was there an overlap between running the haulage company and starting the consultancy? Or did you stop the haulage business and then just go straight into consultancy?
There was an overlap. The haulage business failed a couple of years later because we got overexposed in the high interest rates at the time.
Yes.
We had a mini recession in the early 80s. So the bank decided they weren't going to support me anymore on that. But we were building the training business then. So
did you see that as your future, the training?
I was planning to run both. Right. I was planning to run both. The entrepreneurship. Well, you get knocked over and you stand up, pick yourself up and get on, don't you? And you look for the opportunity that's standing in front of you. And the opportunity for us then was that training program.
Were there other people doing it or did you see
the market? Yeah, there was quite a few startups getting into company driver training, led the IAM and BSM were two of the starters. There's quite a lot of small private startups at the time.
But there was no dominant force. There was no sort of there was no actual thing, was there, as far as driver training?
No.
Were BSM, or were they doing it for fleets and HGVs, or did you see HGV as your niche area to pursue?
Well, they were doing it for both, but I saw HGV as my niche area because I knew the industry and I'd got contacts and I could talk about that sector. And I didn't have the contacts in the car fleet sector. So, although later on, I did attract one or two companies, notably Sandvik. We did this style of work for Sandvik for about 20 years.
What characteristics do good clients have? When you're looking for a client, what do you want from that client?
Just to be positive. On the basis, I think, everybody, whether you're a buyer, a user, a provider, a seller, everyone has the intention to do their best. And I think the most valuable thing you can have with a client is positivity, that what you are doing is your best, but might be improved if you shifted it a little bit.
Yeah, I totally understand that. I read it over the weekend. It was in the Financial Times, actually. It was Arsene Wenger, you know, the Arsenal manager. And he was talking about motivating millionaire footballers. He said, well, you can't motivate people. It's not the right way of doing it. What you have to do, they need to be motivated themselves, and you need to create a performance culture that they can improve themselves, and they want to improve themselves. Which I've seen your online training. That's what I'd like to talk about, and it's fabulous. We discussed it during April,
and
maybe we'll talk about that off air actually. But in terms of the online training, when did you take it online?
Okay, just 2 years ago, actually. I talked about the Toolbox Talk program I started 30 years ago with my own drivers. We took that into our behavioural workshops and we wrote a big, thick management manual with all of everything I'd learned myself on the ground. And people have been hugely appreciative of that. I have to say, we've had hundreds of wonderful clients because they've reflected on what we have done and we've been received very positively. I learned a big lesson, though, about the transport industry, which was a problem that I had 30 years ago, which is why I was out on Sunday afternoons talking to drivers, and that everybody has, which is these Toolbox Talks are fabulous, David, but we just don't have the time to get face to face with drivers. Either they're out when we've got the time, or when they're in the yard, they either want to get home or they're reloading, or now we're busy because it's late in the day. It's just so difficult to get a regular routine going with every driver. And you know, you've got to do it with every driver. So about 3 years ago, you know Susie, don't you, my colleague?
Susie? I do, yeah, yeah. I spoke to you. She has a brilliant view looking over the sea. Is she the techie person?
No, but I mean, incredibly, she has gone out to learn from people, practiced, self-taught. You know, 10 years ago, the internet was a mystery to her, but she does an awful lot of the techie. But
how long have you been together? How long have you been in business together?
Probably 10 years,
right,
I would say.
Yeah.
Susie said to me, look, we need to get, because a lot of the business centered around me with the consultancy and advising advisors that worked with us. Susie said to me, look, we need to get everything that's in your head that you've learned over 30 years, we need to get that out of your head before you snuff it.
Thanks, Susie.
She didn't say that last bit. She would never say that,
yeah.
But I love it because she squeals when I mention that.
You
know, business continuity, we'll call it.
Yeah. Succession planning.
Yeah. So that's how it came about. We were looking for an avenue to scale the business.
Yeah.
Because none of us are getting any younger, are we? And that's what we came up with. And, you know, it's gone, with the people who have signed up to it, it's gone down a bomb,
really.
And that's how we got onto it. We wanted to change the direction of the business to make it a more scalable business. Yeah.
And do you get, do the drivers who complete it and the risk managers who complete it, do they give you feedback and do you alter it according to that feedback? Is it a moving feast?
Well, technically, once software is written, it's written. So it's a complete rewrite to write it again.
Yeah.
But we're in the fortunate position that the way I've approached it seems to be going down really well with managers and drivers. And the way I've done it, I'll use driver's hours as an example. The driver's hours module isn't just about driver's hours. It's about fatigue and driver's hours. That's what it's called. And in the fatigue element, it's educating and supporting drivers to understand why we have driver's hours. It's about their well-being. And it's about their well-being based in relation to their lifestyle, because proper sleep is part of a good lifestyle and a healthy lifestyle. And part of fatigue prevention, so that when you are working, you don't suffer fatigue. So we approach it in that way. It's about behaviour, lifestyle, well-being, health, as well as compliance and associated things like that. And the feedback we get is great, actually. We've got notes of what does come back where we think, oh, we'll tweak that next time round. It's a 3-year cycle.
That's right. I've seen it for the benefit of the listeners who might be interested in this, and this is ITT Hub, so it's innovation in technology and transport. I've seen the product. Just talk me through it. If a new client came to you, what would they get from the program?
Okay. The program is a monthly toolbox talk. It takes about 20 minutes to complete. At the end of each toolbox talk, there's a 5-question quiz to validate the learning. And each toolbox talk is made up of 3 learning points. So we stage between, broadly speaking, the problem, the issues and the circumstances or the location and the solution. What is the right thing to do is how we orientate everything. What's the right thing to do? What's the right thing to do for public safety? What's the right thing to do for fuel economy? What's the right thing to do for the environment? What's the right thing to do for yourself? Take better care of yourself. Don't put yourself under pressure with the stresses that driving brings. You know, Emma Jennings at CILT Education Department a couple of years ago spoke at the Force Conference and said, you know, 21st century training should be continual, user-led, participative, bite-size, on-demand, and mobile. And funnily enough, that's what we created. So the driver gets all those personal benefits about their well-being and also protect themselves, because you know very well, Ian, that enforcement and regulatory control is going to get more, not less. And drivers are exposed to that and helping them know what they ought to do so they don't get fixed penalties and they don't get points on their license and called up before the traffic commissioner. What the company gets is stronger O-license compliance, investment in educating their drivers about the realities of driving at work, health and safety in road haulage, and an ability to demonstrate to the outside world of regulatory authority that they are doing the right thing. And I guess also it's about investing in their drivers' health and well-being. So they get all of that.
Okay, well, two questions that come from that, just in case any listener, any transport manager is interested in this. How much does it cost? And is there a module on driving a Chieftain tank?
I'll answer the second question first. I think there are many modules on driving the Chieftain tank because fundamentally driving any vehicle requires the same approach in procedure. And we go right back to the beginning of the conversation. How does the army do what it gets done? And the procedures are the foundation for everything. And it's the same with driving, and it's the same with getting on and off and in and out of your vehicle. So I think, yeah, the principles in all the modules were suitable for a driver of any vehicle. And how much does it cost, I think, was the other one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's only £5 per module per driver per month. So for £60 a year, you get a full training program covering so much of what a driver needs to know and how he needs to do it to make your business successful and their lifestyle less risky.
Okay, well, I'm running out of time, but I'm trying to learn how to do podcasts, and I'm listening to... I listened to one last night from Alec Baldwin, who's far more articulate and far more interesting than I. So anyone who's listened to this, you might want to tune into Alec Baldwin rather than myself. I think his is called Here's the Thing. But he was talking about working with Jack Nicholson and about giving direction. And so the director... was trying to give Jack Nicholson some direction during the filming of a movie, which must be difficult. And Jack Nicholson said in his, I can't really do his accent, but he said, there are only two directions, a little more or a little less. So you're giving direction to your clients. So the question for you is, who would play you in a movie?
My goodness me. You know how to gig some questions up, don't you? Something we never, God, I'm struggling now. I tell you who I like is Gary Oldman, who's an understated contributor to the art of the stage. Because he does some very thoughtful parts, and I think he could bring out the character and personality of anyone.
I don't think I can improve upon that, and I'm going to use that as my ending, because Gary Oldman played Churchill in the movie The Gathering Storm, I think it was, and he did it with aplomb. And I can hear him talking on the phone in the movie to Eisenhower, where he offered to carry in some planes across the border into Canada. But we're now going back to the beginning, which was the discussion with David regarding his military career. I thought that was absolutely fascinating. David, thank you for coming on ITT's The Back View.